5. Yankee Women Progressives. The Elys, Commonses and Deweys might have been more notable, but the Yankee Women Progressives provided the shock troops of the progressive movement, and hence the burgeoning welfare state. As in the case of the males, gradual but irresistible secularisation set in over the decades. The abolitionist and slightly later cohort were fanatically post-millennial Christian. But the later progressive cohort, born as we have seen around 1860, were no less fanatical but more secular and less Christian kingdom oriented. The progression was virtually inevitable. After all, if your activism as a Christian evangelist had virtually nothing to do with Christian creed or liturgy or even personal reform, but was focused exclusively in using the force of government to shape up everyone, stamp out sin, and usher in a perfect society, if government is really God's major instrument of salvation, then the role of Christianity in one's practical activity began to fade into the background. Christianity became taken for granted, a background buzz. One's practical activity was designed to use the government to stamp out liquor, poverty, or whatever is defined as sin, and to impose one's own values and principles on the society. Not only that, but by the late 19th century, as the 1860 cohort came of age, there arose greater and more specialised opportunities for female activism on behalf of statism and government intervention. The older groups, the Women's Crusades, were short-run activities, and hence could rely on short bursts of energy by married women. However, as female activism became professionalised and became specialised into social work and settlement houses, there was little room left for any women except upper-class and upper-middle-class spinsters, who answered the call in droves. The settlement houses, it must be emphasised, were not simply centres for private help to the poor, they were, quite consciously, spearheads for social change and government intervention and reform. The most prominent of the Yankee progressive social workers, and emblematic of the entire movement, was Jane Addams, born 1860. Her father, John H. Addams, was a pietist Quaker who settled in northern Illinois, constructed a sawmill, invested in railroads and banks, and became one of the wealthiest men in northern Illinois. John H. Adams was a lifelong Republican who attended the founding meeting of the Republican Party at Ripon, Wisconsin in 1854, and served as a Republican state senator for 16 years. Graduating from one of the first all-women colleges, the Rockford Female Seminary, in 1881, Jane Addams was confronted by the death of her beloved father. Intelligent, upper-class and energetic, she was faced with the dilemma of what to do with her life. She had no interest in men, so marriage was not in the cards. Indeed, in her lifetime she seems to have had several intense lesbian affairs. Footnote. Recent feminist historians have been happy to overcome the reluctance of older historians and have proudly outed the lesbianism of Addams and many other spinster Yankee progressive activists of that epoch. Probably these feminists are right, and the pervasive lesbianism of the movement is crucial to a historical understanding of why this movement got underway. At the very least, they could not simply follow other women and make a career of marriage and homemaking. End footnote. After 8 years of indecision, Jane Addams decided to devote herself to social work and founded the famed settlement house Hull House in the Chicago slums in 1889. Jane was inspired by reading the highly influential English art critic John Ruskin, who was an Oxford professor, Christian socialist, and bitter critic of laissez-faire capitalism. Ruskin was the charismatic leader of Christian socialism in England, which was influential in the ranks of the Anglican clergy. One of his disciples was the historian Arnold Toynbee, in whose honour Canon Samuel A. Barnett, another Ruskinian, founded the settlement house of Toynbee Hall in London in 1884. In 1888, Jane Addams went to London to observe Toynbee Hall, and there she met Canon W. H. Freemantle close friend and mentor of Canon Barnett, and this visit settled the matter, inspiring Jane Addams to go back to Chicago to found Hull House, along with her former classmate and intimate lesbian friend, Ellen Gates Starr. The major difference between Toynbee Hall and its American counterparts is that the former was staffed by male social workers, who stayed for a few years and then moved on to build their careers, whereas the American settlement houses almost all constituted lifelong careers for spinster ladies. Jane Addams was able to use her upper-class connections to acquire fervent supporters, many of them women who became intimate and probably lesbian friends of Miss Addams. One staunch financial supporter was Mrs. Louise de Koven Bowen, born 1859, whose father John de Koven, a Chicago banker, had amassed a great fortune. Mrs. Bowen became an intimate friend of Jane Addams. She also became the treasurer and even built a house for the settlement. Other society women supporters of Hull House included Mary Rosett Smith, who had a lesbian affair with Jane Addams, and Mrs. Russell Wright, the mother of the future renowned architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Mary Rosett Smith, indeed, was able to replace Ellen Starr in Jane Addams's lesbian affection. She did so in two ways, by being totally submissive and self-deprecating to the militant Miss Addams, and by supplying copious financial support to Hull House. Mary and Jane proclaimed themselves married to each other. One of Jane Addams's close colleagues and probable lesbian lover at Hull House was the tough, truculent Julia Clifford Lathrop, born 1858, whose father William had migrated from upstate New York to Rockford in northern Illinois. Footnote: it is all too clear that in her 1910 autobiography, Jane Addams lied by ennobling her motivation for founding Hull House, claiming that it was the sheer horror of watching a bullfight in Spain. None of that alleged horror shines through her letters at the time. End footnote. William Lathrop, an attorney, was a descendant of the eminent English nonconformist and Yankee minister, the Reverend John Lathrop. William became a trustee of the Rockford Female Seminary and was elected Republican U.S. Senator from Illinois. His daughter Julia graduated from the seminary earlier than Addams and then went on to Vassar College. Julia Lathrop moved to Hull House in 1890 and from there developed a lifelong career in social work and government service. Julia founded the first juvenile court in the country, in Chicago in 1899, and then moved on to become the first female member of the Illinois State Board of Charities and president of the National Conference of Social Work. In 1912, Lathrop was appointed by President Taft as head of the first U.S. Children's Bureau. Ensconced in the federal government, the Children's Bureau became an outpost of the welfare state and social work, engaging in activities that eerily and unpleasantly remind one of the modern era. Thus, the Children's Bureau became an unremitting centre of propaganda and advocacy of federal subsidies, programmes and propaganda on behalf of the nation's mothers and children, a kind of grisly foreshadowing of family values and Hillary Rodham Clinton's concerns for the children and the Children's Defence Fund. Thus, the Children's Bureau proclaimed Baby Week in March 1916 and again in 1917, and designated the entire year 1918 as the Year of the Child. After World War I, Lathrop and the Children's Bureau lobbied for and pushed through Congress in late 1921 the Sheppard-Towner Maternity and Infancy Protection Act, providing federal funds to states that set up child hygiene or child welfare bureaus, as well as providing public instruction in maternal and infant care by nurses and physicians. Here we had the beginnings of socialized medicine, as well as the socialized family. This public instruction was provided in home conferences and health centers, and to healthcare professionals in each area. It was also chillingly provided that these states, under the carrot of federal subsidy, would remove children from the homes of parents providing inadequate home care. The standard of adequacy to be determined, of course, by the government and its alleged professionals. There was also to be compulsory birth registration for every baby and federal aid for maternity and infancy. Julia Lathrop was instrumental in persuading Shepherd Towner to change the original bill from a welfare measure to those unable to pay into a bill designed to encompass everyone. As Lathrop put it, "The bill is designed to emphasise public responsibility for the protection of life, just as already through our public schools we recognise public responsibility in the education of children." The logic of cumulative government intervention was irresistible. It's unfortunate that no one turned the logic the other way and instituted a drive for the abolition of public schooling. If none of the opponents of Shepherd Tower went so far as to call for the abolition of public schooling, James A. Reed, Democrat, Missouri, the staunch laissez-faire senator, did well enough. Caustically, Senator Reed declared that "it is now proposed to turn the control of the mothers of the land over to a few single ladies holding government jobs in Washington. We would better reverse the proposal and provide for a committee of mothers to take charge of the old maids and teach them how to acquire a husband and have babies of their own." Perhaps Senator Reed thereby cut to the heart of the motivation of these Yankee progressives. At about the same time that Jane Addams and friends were founding Hull House, settlement houses were being founded in New York and Boston, also by spinster Yankee females, and also under the inspiration of Toynbee Hall. Actually, the founder of the first ephemeral settlement in New York was the male Stanton Coit, born 1857, born in northern Ohio to a prosperous merchant and a descendant of the Puritan Massachusetts Yankee, John Coit. Coit obtained a PhD from the University of Berlin, worked at Toynbee Hall, and then established the short-lived Neighborhood Guild settlement in New York in 1886. It failed the following year. Inspired by this example, however, three Yankee lesbians followed by founding the College Settlement Association in 1887, which established college settlements in New York in 1889 and in Boston and Philadelphia several years later. The leading female founder was Vida Dutton Scudder, born 1861, a wealthy Bostonian and daughter of a Congregational missionary to India. After graduating from Smith College in 1884, Vida studied literature at Oxford and became a disciple of Ruskin and a Christian socialist, ending up teaching at Wellesley College for over 40 years. Vida Scudder became an Episcopalian, a Frank socialist, and a member of the Women's Trade Union League. The two other founders of the college settlements were Catherine Coman, born 1857, and her longtime lesbian lover, Catherine Lee Bates. Catherine Coman was born in northern Ohio to a farmer who had been an ardent abolitionist and teacher in upstate New York, and who moved to a farm in Ohio as a result of wounds suffered in the Civil War. Graduating from the University of Michigan, Coman taught history and political economy at Wellesley, and later became chairman of the Wellesley Department of Economics. Coman and Bates travelled to Europe to study and promote social insurance in the United States. Catherine Bates was a professor of English at Wellesley. Coman became a leader of the National Consumers League and of the Women's Trade Union League. The founder of the concept of the Children's Bureau, Florence Kelly, who lobbied for both the Children's Bureau and Shepherd Towner, was one of the few women activists who was in some way unique and not paradigmatic. In many ways, she did share the traits of other progressive ladies. She was born in 1859. Her father was a wealthy, lifelong Republican congressman from Philadelphia, William D. Kelly, whose devotion to protective tariffs, especially for the Pennsylvania iron industry, was so intense as to earn him the sobriquet Pig Iron Kelly. A Protestant Irishman, he was an abolitionist and radical Republican. Florence Kelly differed from her colleagues on two counts. One, she was the only one who was an outright Marxist, and two, she was married and not a lesbian. However, in the long run, these differences did not matter very much, for Kelly's open Marxism was not, in practice, very different in policy conclusions from the less systematic Fabian socialism or progressivism of her sisterhood. As such, she was able to take her place at the end of a spectrum that was not really very far from the mainstream of non-Marxian ladies. On the second count, Florence Kelly managed to dispose of her husband in fairly short order, and to palm off the raising of her three children onto doting friends. Thus, home and hearth proved no obstacle to Florence Kelly's militancy. Graduating from Cornell, Florence went to study at the University of Zurich. There she promptly became a Marxist and translated Engels's Condition of the Working Class in England into English. In Zurich, Florence met and married a Russian-Jewish Marxist medical student, Lazar Wishniewetsky, in 1884, moving with her husband to New York and having three children by 1887. In New York, Florence promptly formed the New York Consumers League and got a law passed for inspecting women in factories. In 1891, Florence fled her husband with her kids and went to Chicago for reasons that remain unknown to her biographers. In Chicago, she gravitated inevitably to Hull House, where she stayed for a decade. During this time, the large, volcanic and blustery Florence Kelly helped to radicalise Jane Addams. Kelly lobbied successfully in Illinois for a law creating a legal maximum 8-hour workday for women. She then became the first chief factory inspector in the state of Illinois, gathering about her an all-socialist staff. Florence Kelly's husband, Dr. Wishniewetsky, had been pushed off the pages of history. But what about her children? While Florence went about the task of socialising Illinois, she was able to pass off the raising of her children onto her friends Henry Demarest Lloyd, prominent leftist Chicago Tribune journalist, and his wife, the daughter of one of the owners of the Tribune. In 1899, Florence Kelly returned to New York, where she resided for the next quarter century at what was by then the most prominent settlement house in New York City, the Henry Street Settlement on the Lower East Side. There, Kelly founded the National Consumers League and was the chief lobbyist for the Federal Children's Bureau and for Shepard Towner. She battled for minimum wage laws and maximum hours laws for women, fought for an Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution, and was a founding member of the NAACP. When accused of being a Bolshevik in the 1920s, Florence Kelly disingenuously pointed to her Philadelphia blue blood heritage. How could someone of such a family possibly be a Marxist? Another prominent and very wealthy Yankee woman in New York City was Mary Melinda Kingsbury Simcovich, born 1867. Born in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, Mary Melinda was the daughter of Isaac Kingsbury, a prominent Congregationalist and Republican merchant. She was the niece of an executive of the Pennsylvania Railroad and a cousin of the head of Standard Oil of California. Graduating from Boston University, Mary Melinda toured Europe with her mother, studied in Germany, and was deeply moved by socialism and Marxism. Becoming engaged to Vladimir Simcovich, a Russian scholar, she joined him in New York when he acquired a post at Columbia. Before marrying Simcovich, Mary Melinda became head resident of the college settlement in New York, studied socialism further, and learned Yiddish so as to be able to communicate better with her Lower East Side neighbours. Even after marrying Simcovich and acquiring two children, Mary Melinda founded her own settlement at Greenwich House, joined the New York Consumers League and Women's Trade Union League, and fought for government old age pensions and public housing. Particularly important for New York statism and social reform were the wealthy and socially prominent Dreer family, which gave rise to several active daughters. The Dreers were German Americans, but they could just as well have been Yankees, since they were fervent, if not fanatical, German evangelical pietists. Their father, Theodor Dreyer, was an emigrant from Bremen who had risen to become a successful merchant, During the Civil War, he returned to Bremen and married his younger cousin, Dorothy Dreher, the daughter of an evangelical minister. Every morning, the four Dreher daughters and their brother Edward, born 1872, were swathed in Bible readings and the singing of hymns. In 1898, Father Dreher died, leaving several $1 million to his family. Eldest daughter Margaret, born 1868, was able to dominate her siblings into engaging in radical and philanthropic activities at her beck and call. Footnote: the one sister who slightly broke the Dreher mould was Catherine, born 1877, an artist and patroness of modern art who, interested in organic philosophy, became pro-Nazi during the 1930s. End footnote. To dramatise her altruism and alleged sacrifice, Margaret Dreher habitually wore shoddy clothes. Active in the Consumers League, Margaret joined and heavily financed the New Women's Trade Union League in late 1904, joined by her sister Mary. Soon Margaret was president of the New York WTUL and treasurer of the National WTUL. Indeed, Margaret Dreher presided over the WTUL from 1907 until 1922. In the spring of 1905, Margaret Dreher met and married the Chicago-based progressive adventurer Raymond Robbins, born 1873. They had met, appropriately enough, when Robbins delivered a lecture on the social gospel at an evangelical church in New York. The Robbinses became the country's premier progressive couple. Margaret's activities scarcely slowed down, since Chicago was at least as active a centre for the welfare reformers as New York. Raymond Robbins had a checkered career as a wanderer and nomad. Born in Florida, deserted by his father and absent a mother, Robbins wandered around the country and managed to earn a law degree in California, where he became a pro-union progressive. Prospecting gold in Alaska, he saw a vision of a flaming cross in the Alaska wilds and became a social gospel-oriented minister. Moving to Chicago in 1901, Robbins became a leading settlement house worker, associating, of course, with Hull House and St. Jane Addams. 2 years after the Robbins-Dreher marriage, Sister Mary Dreher came to Robbins and confessed her overwhelming love. Robbins persuaded Mary to transmute her shameful secret passion on the altar of leftist social reform, and the two of them engaged in a lifelong secret correspondence based on their two-person Order of the Flaming Cross. Perhaps the most important function of Margaret Dreher for the cause was her success in bringing top female wealth into financial and political support of the leftist and welfare state programs of the Women's Trade Union League. Included among WTUL supporters were Anne Morgan, daughter of J. Pierpont Morgan, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, daughter of John D. Rockefeller Jr., Dorothy Whitney Strait, heiress to the Rockefeller-oriented Whitney family, Mary Eliza McDowell, born 1854, a Hull House alumnus whose father owned a steel mill in Chicago, and the very wealthy Anita McCormick Blaine, daughter of Cyrus McCormick, inventor of the mechanical reaper, who had already been inducted into the movement by Jane Addams. We should not leave the Chicago scene without noting a crucial activist and academic transition to the next generation. An important academic wealthy spinster was Sophonisba Breckinridge, born 1866, who came from a prominent Kentucky family and was the great-granddaughter of a US senator. She, too, was not a Yankee, but she was pretty clearly a lesbian. Unhappy as a lawyer in Kentucky, Sophonisba went to the University of Chicago Graduate School and became the first woman PhD in political science in 1901. She continued to teach social science and social work at the University of Chicago for the rest of her career, becoming the mentor and probable long-time lesbian companion of Edith Abbott, born 1876. Edith Abbott, born in Nebraska, had been secretary of the Boston Trade Union League and had studied at the London School of Economics, where she was strongly influenced by the Webbs, leaders of Fabian socialism. She lived and worked, predictably, at a London settlement house. Then Edith studied for a PhD in economics at the University of Chicago, which she earned in 1905. Becoming an instructor at Wellesley, Edith soon joined her slightly younger sister Grace at Hull House in 1908, where the two sisters lived for the next dozen years, Edith as social research director of Hull House. In the early 1920s, Edith Abbott became dean of the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration and co-edited the school's Social Service Review with her friend and mentor, Sophonisba Breckenridge. Grace Abbott, 2 years younger than Edith, took more of an activist route. The Abbott sisters' mother had come from upstate New York and graduated from Rockford Female Seminary. Their father was an Illinois lawyer who became Lieutenant Governor of Nebraska. Grace Abbott, also living at Hull House and a close friend of Jane Addams, became Julia Clifford Lathrop's assistant at the Federal Children's Bureau in 1917, and in 1921 succeeded her mentor Lathrop as head of the Children's Bureau. If the female social reform activists were almost all Yankee, by the late 19th century, Jewish women were beginning to add their leaven to the lump. Of the crucial 1860s cohort, the most important Jewess was Lillian D. Wald, born 1867. Born to an upper-middle-class German and Polish Jewish family in Cincinnati, Lillian and her family soon moved to Rochester, where she became a nurse. She then organized in the Lower East Side of New York the Nurses' Settlement, which was soon to become the famed Henry Street Settlement. It was Lillian Wald who first suggested a federal children's bureau to President Theodore Roosevelt in 1905, and who led the agitation for a federal constitutional amendment outlawing child labor. While she was not a Yankee, Lillian Wald continued in the dominant tradition by being a lesbian, forming a long-term lesbian relationship with her associate, Lavinia Dock. Wald, while not wealthy herself, had an uncanny ability to gain financing for Henry Street, including top Jewish financiers such as Jacob Schiff and Mrs. Solomon Loeb of the Wall Street investment banking firm of Kuhn Loeb, and Julius Rosenwald, then head of Sears Roebuck. Also prominent in financing Henry Street was the Milbank Fund, of the Rockefeller-affiliated family who owned the Borden Milk Company. Rounding out the important contingent of socialist activist Jews were the four Goldmark sisters, Helen, Pauline, Josephine, and Alice. Their father had been born in Poland, became a physician in Vienna, and was a member of the Austrian Parliament. Fleeing to the United States after the failed revolution of 1848, Dr. Goldmark became a physician and chemist, became wealthy by inventing percussion caps, and helped organize the Republican Party in the 1850s. The Goldmarks settled in Indiana. Dr. Goldmark died in 1881, leaving eldest daughter Helen as the head of the family. Helen married the eminent Felix Adler, philosopher and founder of the Society for Ethical Culture in New York, a kind of Jewish Unitarianism. Alice married the eminent Boston Jewish lawyer Louis Dembetz Brandeis, helping to radicalize Brandeis from moderate classical liberal to socialistic progressive. Pauline, born 1874, after graduating from Bryn Mawr in 1896, remained single, did graduate work at Columbia and Barnard in botany, zoology, and sociology, and then became assistant secretary of the New York Consumers League. Even more successful an activist was Josephine Clara Goldmark, born 1877, who graduated from Bryn Mawr in 1898, did graduate work in education at Barnard, and then became publicity secretary of the National Consumers League and author of the NCL's annual handbooks. In 1908, Josephine became chairman of the new NCL Committee on Legislation, and she, her sister Pauline, and Florence Kelly, along with Alice, persuaded Brandeis to write his famed Brandeis Brief in the case of Muller v. Oregon, 1908, claiming that the Oregon maximum hours law for women was constitutional. In 1919, Josephine Goldmark continued her rise by becoming secretary of the Rockefeller Foundation's Committee for the Study of Nursing Education. Josephine Goldmark culminated her career by writing the first hagiographical biography of her close friend and mentor in socialistic activism, Florence Kelly.